Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All. Less work, more clean. Terms apply.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Welcome to the Nailing the Apex. We have another race week upon us. Tim Haraney. I want to talk Chinese Grand Prix with you, our very first one since 2019. But first, let's talk about the calendar change for 2025. Why, Tim, is this a huge deal?
Well, Adam, I mean, it just means we get 24 races again on a massive calendar that sees everybody go around the world in the span of March to December. So, I mean, it's big in terms of just how early they put it out, because usually we're waiting until August, September for them to finalize something. But it just shows, I mean, obviously the health of the sport. But at the same time, I mean, I think also that the tracks have signed such long-term agreements that F1 pretty much knows where it's heading, when it's heading there. And I'm glad we are starting things off with Australia. Because
why is that?
I mean, for me, it's just like a classic. I mean, I just remember as a kid waking up at like 1 a.m. watching this with my dad, and it's always been like that for me until obviously the past few seasons. So
right.
I really enjoy having Australia kick everything off. As for the testing, I'll be interested to see what they do. I mean, I have a feeling they'll probably end up going back to Bahrain for preseason testing. Mm-hmm. But I mean, let's just wait and see, because you know, I remember back in the day again, like the Circuit de Catalunya, like the track in Barcelona, you know, they used to have 2 weeks of testing there. You know, it was like,
right.
I believe it was, if I remember correctly, it was like 3 or 4 days each week and whatever. I was there in 2017 for covering testing for the 2 weeks and whatever. It was awesome. It was so much fun. The access that we had gotten was great. And as a fan, I mean, if you ever get the chance, you should try and get to preseason testing simply because the rules are a little more lax and you can do a little more stuff.
So it's interesting that you bring up testing. I was looking at the F1 calendar. And by the way, for anybody that doesn't know, a lot of the changes start in the first five races. So you got Australia, you've got China, you've got Japan, Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, and then Miami. And Miami will be early. It'll be in early May next year. But, you know, one of the things that we talked about this year after Bahrain is that you don't get a sense of what the cars really are until after Australia, right? It was Bahrain, Jeddah, which is a super tight street circuit, and then Australia, which is, yes, a street circuit, but also a little bit more of a racetrack, right? A traditional racetrack with open corners and that sort of thing. And I wonder, Tim, if testing in Bahrain kind of throws everybody off too, because that the thing about it, and I don't think everybody knows this, is that, you know, the pavement there is really hard on tires. Is that a benefit or not?
I don't think so, because of just how difficult the surface is, right? Like it's not like regular tarmac. If you ever get a chance to go and you get close to the track or as close as you can get to the surface, I mean, you can see that it's like super abrasive. And so there's not many tracks in the calendar that are that abrasive. And it is something that we talked about on this podcast during the Bahrain Grand Prix when I got to go and cover that. And just seeing the surface up close and personal, I was kind of just like, oh my God, I can't believe that, you know, it's built like this. Mm-hmm. And so I think you don't get a really good gauge on where everybody kind of is. You don't get a good gauge on how teams and cars like what level of degradation their cars are able to withstand while running the Pirelli tire. But I think also, like, Adam, I like the fact that we're kind of moving away from that for the first race of the season, because we may start to get a bit better understanding of what everybody's got. Like, once we get through, let's say, if preseason testing's in Spain, which is, you know, a natural road course, the surface there is quite, you know, normal, we should say. Mm-hmm. But we get a better understanding of where everybody is. Teams get a better understanding of like what their cars can actually do. But again, I mean, with this current regulation, we sometimes kind of get into the seasons now for the past few years, and we don't really know what everybody has until we get to like race, you know, 3, 4, or 5. I mean, I think we have a pretty good understanding now of where everyone is after Japan, because I think Japan's like a great barometer to know where everybody actually is. And I think moving forward, Adam, it's all going to be about upgrades, who's bringing what now from here on out. We kind of understand what the pecking order is. But the more I kind of look at this calendar, the more I have just a concern over like people's health, well-being. I mean, we have to remember that, you know, these teams, the crew, like it's a lot of travel. Mm-hmm. Like that's a lot. That's a long time to be away from home. It's a long time to be away from, you know, your family and things of that nature. And I think teams are getting a little bit better of having crews that can like rotate out, but not everybody can do that with inside the F1 team. There are a lot of team personnel who, you know, have to go to almost all of these events. And so that's quite difficult. I mean, for the drivers, it's a challenge, but it's not as big as like everybody else, right? I mean, the drivers have obviously being the athlete, you have things a little bit easier in that respect. And the drivers do understand that. And they talk about that pretty openly, the fact that just how difficult this is on the team and the crew. And so that would be my only concern, just the calendar just getting too big, Adam. It's just, I think 24 is too many. I don't know how you feel about it, but I think 24 is too many. But
I am pro as many races as we can fit into a year. But I understand the human cost there. And it's exhausting. And I'm looking at some of these travel schedules, right? So Saudi Arabia is the fifth race on the schedule next year, April 18th to 20th. So next year, this time, this is what we're going to be talking about. But then they move directly to the United States for the Miami Grand Prix 2 weeks later. And then 2 weeks after that, you start a three-race leg in Europe. And then you're back to Canada for Montreal. And then you're over to Austria. And again, there are two-week breaks in between these travel periods. But you got to remember like how long it takes you when you're jet-lagged to get on the schedule of wherever you're supposed to be. And one place I was actually thinking, like if they were going to change the schedule up, was Belgium. I thought, can you find a spot not in the summer in the rainy season? Because it's everybody's favorite course. It's such a fun drive. And when it gets rained out, it is such a bummer, right? You know that you can't help the weather in Belgium. The weather is what the weather is. It does rain there. Can you not put that early spring or late fall or somewhere where like Imola is going to be, you know, another race that got rained out last year. Imola is going to be May 16th through 18th. You know, why can't, and I'm sure there's logistical reasons why, but I just kind of wonder if you're going to do a couple European legs, why not put Belgium at the beginning because of just the realities of the weather there?
Yeah. And it's trying to like get, it's trying to make sure that the calendar, well, at least they're trying to get to that where it makes sense of how you travel. And because, you know, if you go back to last year, you know, you were going from like Baku all the way over to like Miami in the span of a week. And it's like, hold on a second. How does that make any sense? Right?
Yeah.
Like that's really taxing on your, that's really taxing on your personnel.
Oh my gosh.
I think, and then also the triple headers, right, Adam? I mean, like the triple headers, like some of those like weren't easy. I'm trying to remember what last year's was. It was like Vegas, Qatar, then was it Abu Dhabi? I think it
was. Yeah, is a crazy amount of travel.
Like that's a huge amount, dude. Like I did Texas, Mexico, and then I was going to go to Brazil, and I was like, you know what? Maybe I won't go to Brazil because I've got to spend 2 weeks in Vegas. So my calendar would have looked like my calendar would have looked like Texas, Mexico. If I had have done Brazil, Brazil straight to Vegas, mm-hmm. Vegas for 2 weeks back to Canada. And for some folks, it was like Texas, Mexico, Brazil, UK, Vegas, Qatar, that's Abu Dhabi. That's if that's I'm pretty sure it was Qatar, Abu Dhabi. That's how they finished last year. Mine's
of course, and you know, yeah, it was Qatar, Abu Dhabi, but you do feel like, yeah, the last few years, it's just wiped. There's no tradition anymore. It's completely wiped the memory.
The thing is that's a ton of travel. That's mm-hmm. really hard. That's very difficult to kind of push through and get through. And I remember I got really sick at the end of that leg. So did a lot of other people who were in F1. I think like, oh man, there's so many of us who ended up getting the flu after Vegas. Like it was brutal. Let me pull up the calendar to make sure I got the order in which the calendar went. Sorry, everyone. It was it went Vegas, then straight into Abu Dhabi. I don't know what the hell I was thinking with Qatar.
And you know what? The rest of us don't either. We're really mad.
Because it went
at you.
Qatar.
We're so upset. How did you not have that yeah. offhand?
Yeah. Ooh. It's because it went Qatar, Texas. That's what it was. Mexico, Brazil, Vegas, Abu Dhabi. Like, that's a stretch, man. That's a tough stretch.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was last year. And so, same sort of similar type of stuff going on for this year and then next year as well. And so, yeah, I don't know, Adam. It's that is quite a bit. And then I don't know if you have like a bit of fan fatigue, right? Like it's,
yep.
And especially if it's like the racing, like if there isn't anything on the line, like let's say the championship is over with whatever, 6 races to go or 7 races to go or 8 races to go. Right, Adam? Like, it's just, how do you kind of keep the fan engaged still? And mm-hmm. then you kind of get that fatigue of like 3 races back to back, where it's like, well, the championships have already been sewn up. So
yeah, exactly. So yeah, it's an interesting calendar. I think they're at their max with what they can bring, and I think we're going to see rotating races here in the next few years.
Yeah,
where
probably,
you know, yeah. I mean, I think Formula for Success, which is Eddie Jordan and David Coulthard's podcast, was talking about what it would take to bring a race back to South Africa, and you know how one of the organizers there, the guys who does Formula E, was really hooked in with Nelson Mandela and that sort of thing. The reality of the situation is right now it's just not sustainable in South Africa specifically. And he said, I don't want to bring it back for 3 years. I want to bring it back for every year. Mm-hmm. And I just don't know, Tim, if that's going to be possible for a lot of these races. And, and you know, they talked about this a little bit with Spa potentially leaving the calendar and Monaco potentially leaving the calendar. And I think, obviously, those are two classic tracks that you never want to see. F1 fans never want to see a season without them. Although Monaco has its detractors just because you can't do anything in Monaco anymore.
Yeah.
But, you know, maybe there is some intelligence in, you know, places like South Africa where maybe the investment levels aren't the same as they would be in the United States, of course. Mm-hmm. And, okay, we need you to do a race once every 3 or 4 years. Can mm-hmm. you do that? Mm-hmm. And having rotational... Mm-hmm. Okay, we've got this hemisphere rotates these races in, this hemisphere rotates these races in. Mm-hmm. See a few more locales, let F1, you know, and that only's got to be 2 or 3 races on the calendar that switch every year. Mm-hmm. But it could make for just a little bit more of a global outreach. Because right now things, you know, Africa specifically has no race. Mm-hmm. And you need a world championship, right?
No, you're right. So. And I think that's smart. I mean, it is something that F1 has been playing around with, that idea of like rotating in a races. I would like to see it. I mean, it mixes up the calendar for sure. I remember back in the day, like when I think it was when Bernie Ecclestone and the crew there were making up the calendar. And I think, like, if I remember correctly, a lot of the times the way that they were plotting out the geography of how they went to which races was the rainy seasons. Like, were they going to, you know, were they going to a place when it was during their rainy season so they could avoid having to deal with racing in the wet and all that kind of stuff? And now, like, when you look at it, it kind of is, they haven't really avoided something like that. I mean, I remember, like you said, like Imola last year getting rained out, obviously with the horrible floods that were going on there. And and all that, like, and then having to cancel the race and all that kind of stuff. So, I mean, you kind of have to look at geography that way a bit, but at the same time, I mean, I think it makes more sense to do your calendar based on like trajectory, like where are you going? Like, I think starting off this year, even though it's kind of, it's been a little bit tough for the viewer because in Canada and United States and the East Coast, West Coast, is because obviously you're now watching the race at like, I mean, this weekend's going to be what, like 2 and 3 in the morning to watch the race. I mean, you're doing that all up front. So you're doing that with Australia, you're doing that with Japan, you're doing that with China to start off the year next year. But at the same time, in terms of freighting, in terms of like logistics, getting everybody to these places, it does make more sense.
Agreed. Yeah. Well, I always felt like too, maybe, you know, if you're trying to avoid rainy seasons, you can use the Middle Eastern tracks as a great stopgap, right? You know, if you're saying that this part of Europe's going to be in its rainy season, well, you know where it's not. And, you know, I know Abu Dhabi's got to be the last, like Yas Marina's got to be the last one. I get it, but it just feels like I think there's got to be a balance between regionality and, of course, not getting rained out, because nobody wants to see a race rained out when you've waited 2 weeks and get all excited. And basically all the cars are flown in anyway, so it's a waste of money. Now, one of the things that we're going to see in our first Grand Prix since 2019, we'll do a little bit more of a preview on Thursday, is the first sprint race of the season. There have been a lot of changes to this format since it was introduced 3-4 years ago, Tim. And last year, to me, seemed like the most disjointed version of it, because it was like, well, you're going to race and then you're going to qualify and you know, does this count or whatever? So what do we know? They've rejigged the rules again. What are the sprint race rules now?
Yeah, just so you can get that park for May, right? I mean, if you go back to the Austin, the USGP last year, and then obviously we had Lewis Hamilton getting busted with the plank wear. That was actually a really great race from him and Mercedes. So it's a shame that actually happened.
It was great.
They had brought a new floor to the car, and seeing as how they only had one practice session, they never really could get they couldn't get like a good barometer of where like the floor was in relation to the ground. So the ride height of the car, they weren't able to get that dialed in just right. So they were getting great performance, but they weren't getting all the plank wear, and they ended up getting all of the plank wear. They got disqualified.
Yes.
So a big part of that with this is essentially making sure that Park for May rule doesn't really come in until after you qualify for the Grand Prix, which is going to be held on Saturday. So your Saturday qualifying for the Grand Prix like normal, but you're also getting that sprint race in as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So that feels a little bit less disjointed?
I would say so. I mean, like, I think a big part of it, like Adam, is trying to make sure that teams are able to kind of get that like optimization in, like making sure that you're optimizing the package that you have without, you know. Yeah, I think a big part of it is the sprint races. I mean, however you feel about them, I'm not a huge sprint race guy. I don't get overly excited with them because they haven't been great. I mean, if you were to reverse the grids, you know, I could be persuaded to have an interest in them a little bit more, but like, I obviously cover them for sure, but I just don't really care for them much. Right.
Like,
it doesn't, it's not like the Grand Prix, right? You're working a weekend with this. It's kind of like you're getting one practice and then, okay, it's, you know, time to qualify for your sprint race and do your sprint race and all that other good stuff. And I think you miss that window of really trying to figure out where the car is, and that can take away from your Grand Prix. So think about if you're battling for a championship and then all of a sudden you come to a weekend, it throws a huge wrench into everything, and now you're not really battling for a championship because of the sprint race.
Yeah.
And so you put all that work in. And so, I mean, it was something similar to, what was it, 2021 Brazil, I remember, you know, remember Lewis was gaining on Max in that championship, and then we had the sprint in Brazil, and he took a penalty for something and was at the back. And if he didn't have a good sprint race, who's to say he would have done well in, you know, anything after that?
Agreed.
Yeah, right? That could have been, you know, pretty brutal for him. So,
well, Max Verstappen said that, and I quote directly, "I think it's not great to do," meaning having the sprint race in China, because when you've been away from a track for quite a while, I think that you never know what you're going to experience. So it would have been better to have a normal race weekend there. On the other hand, it's probably spices things up a bit more, and maybe what they, meaning Formula One and the fans, would like to see. But purely from a driving and performance perspective of the sport, it's not the smartest thing to do. It was the last set of regulations the last time we raced at this course, so we don't have any idea. And Andrea Stella said that this weekend for McLaren specifically is going to be a weekend of damage control, specifically citing, Tim, the fact that he said you have so many low-speed hairpins. Even in corner two, corner three, you spend a long time in the corners. He said China might be a bit of damage limitation for us. And then from Miami onwards, hopefully, we kind of set a better stage. So what does he mean by that in relation to the McLaren car? Why are they at a disadvantage?
Their car is just not great in slow speed corners, right? And especially corners that are long in duration. So the longer the trajectory of the corner, the more time you spend in the corner, especially if it's slow speed, their car just isn't really strong in those circumstances where, like, if you look at the Red Bull, and, you know, I've been saying this since, you know, Bahrain preseason testing, they're really strong in the slow speed stuff. Like, they're very strong.
Yeah.
They're strong everywhere, obviously, but part of their strength is really within the slow speed stuff coming out of the corner, where McLaren suffers a lot. They're great in the high speed stuff, like everybody saw in the first sector in Jeddah, and then again in Japan, really strong there as well. But again, I mean, that's something for them, and Stella had said this, it's going to take them a year to dial that out of the car, because essentially, you know, as you start to make gains with your current car, you know, it's a bit of a balance where it's kind of like, okay, well, we got to give up something to get something. And it's really hard to keep your advantage and then improve on your weakness as well. It takes a long time to sort through all of that, where it's kind of like with McLaren, it's almost like they've doubled down on their strengths, which I think in respect to what they do, I would have done the same thing for sure, right? There's going to be races where they're going to be really strong, but then there's going to be races where they're going to suffer. And it's something in the off season they didn't really address, right? They didn't really, really tackle and address that issue of slower speed corners. It's something that's plagued them for a while now. But I mean, you know, you take a look at a team like Ferrari, strong kind of all around, good all around car. And then as for Max's comments, you know, I tend to agree with him. And a big part of why he's saying that is you're not getting the amount of time you need to optimize the car to get the best performance out of it. So you could see a Grand Prix this weekend, and it could be great, right? Like, don't get me wrong. Like, we could have a great main race on Sunday simply because of the sprint race that we had and the lack of time teams have had to really grab the performance out of the car. So who knows? Maybe Red Bull could actually struggle in a situation like this. Maybe. I mean, obviously they're
difficult to see, but
yeah, I mean, that's a big ask, right? But like at the end of the day, I mean, you could see a really great race on Sunday because of not having those practice sessions to really iron out the details with the car.
Well, and I think it's going to be a fascinating race for a lot of reasons. There's a lot of drivers on this grid that have never raced a Formula One car around this track. Like, it's probably awesome. Half, right? Yeah, so it's significant. And I'm estimating there. I'm sure there'll be somebody in the YouTube comment section who's got the actual number and gets upset that I don't have it.
You're going to get blasted, buddy.
Yeah. Oh, well, I don't care. I get blasted on every show. That's the whole point of YouTube. You're going to get blasted. My point is, I think, you know, like looking at, I'm curious to see if it's veteran presence that wins out or if it's young guys who don't have anything to lose that win out. Like, I look at a guy like Valtteri Bottas, and I know that they've got to get their pit stops under 3 seconds still, and they still haven't been able to do that. There's a guy that has raced really well at this track before when he was in a Mercedes, and does his experience against his teammate, who is a Chinese driver, does that win out? Or is it going to be a guy like who surprises us? Is it like going to be like an Oscar Piastri or Logan Sargeant? You don't know, right? And that's what's going to kind of be fun. Like Daniel and Yuki. I don't think Yuki was in an F1 car the last time they were in China. So is Daniel finally going to out-qualify Yuki? Those are some interesting stories that are kind of developing.
Yeah, actually, that's a great point, Adam. I mean, if we go through some of like, and this is just going off the top of my head. I mean, Sargeant hasn't raced there in F1, obviously. Same with Piastri. Same too can be said about Yuki. Mm-hmm. Zhou hasn't raced there in an F1 car.
I think that was Lando's rookie season.
Yeah, 2019. Like same with George. That was his rookie season as well. His teammate Robert Kubica at that time at Williams. So there's going to be some drivers here who haven't driven at the track. And so it's whether or not they've done enough on the simulator, you know, back at factory, back at home base, to get up to speed. But the other thing with all this is like, there's new track surface there. Like this is all, so there's not a lot of data that's been collected, and that's kind of, you know, going back to what Max was talking about. So there's not a lot of data that's been collected, if at all any, from the track surface that's been laid down since the last time they were there. So they don't really know in terms of tires, what's the tire going to do in relation to what the car is doing, in relation to what the surface is giving them. And so that's another thing that throws a big wrench into everybody's plans at the same time, is the lack of data that they have from compared to the last time that they were there. So, you know, that's also going to be actually an important topic and storyline as we get closer to the race itself. When you're a rookie and you go to a track that you don't really know, you know, you're going to struggle, right? It's not going to be something that's easy to do. And folks would be like, well, they're F1 drivers. Like, it all should be, well, that's not the way it is, because let me tell you something. You're going to go somewhere you've never been. It has different characteristics. There are different components to a track that allow you to do different things with a race car. And I got news for you. Sometimes a little tiny bump somewhere that you've discovered 5 years ago that's still there, that can help you get the car into the corner without having to turn the wheel and scrub speed. So there's a little bit of knowledge for you. So, I mean, every time you're new to a track, you're always taking in information. You're always learning new things. And with the more experienced drivers, I mean, like Lewis Hamilton and Fernando Alonso, I mean, these guys have done tons of laps there. So they really understand the characteristics of the track. The new surface may, you know, throw them for a bit of a loop, but I mean, they have so much experience on the track, they're going to be able to get around that, no problem. But it's just the new guys that are coming to this track, it could be difficult for them to start off with.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The 7-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
And the wrinkle and the thing that makes it fun is it's the first time on these regulations that kicked in a couple years ago. So while everybody's aware of the regulations and the changes it made to the cars, even the experienced guys have no idea how they're totally going to react going around this track, although I'm sure they can figure it out. So it's going to be a fun racing. If you're a racing nerd and you're looking for stuff like that, and by the way, if you're listening to this podcast, you're probably a racing nerd. This is the type of stuff that you look for. It's exciting. This is the the tenth of a tenth that gets you into first place over somebody else. Now, Tim, there's a couple things we want to mention, and I'm going to save some of our prep for later on because we're going to run super long if I go into everything that I had prepped for today's show. But Aston Martin, really important detail here. The Aston Martin brand will be with the Formula One team until at least 2030. This is an enormous win for Formula One, and I think probably an even bigger win for Aston Martin.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, obviously, you know, Lawrence and the consortium that he led to buy up. I think when Lawrence first got involved in Aston Martin Lagonda, which is the auto manufacturer, which is the car company itself, I mean, I think he had put up over 100, well, not just him, but everybody who was involved, over 180 million. And I believe that got him like just over 16%. And then they doubled down on that. And now they have about 25% ownership within the group. I mean, obviously, when you have a board and you have to convince them to, you know, put money somewhere or back something or whatever it is, you have to get everybody on board, right? Like it's not just one person saying, this is what we're doing.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not how it works. You have to get everyone on the same boat and row in the same direction or else just forget about it. So for them to get to reinvest in F1, and their deal was due to run out in 2026. I think a big part of having Fernando Alonso sign on for a longer term, that was important for Aston Martin to say, this makes sense. We've done well with being a part of Formula One. We've seen that our purchasers are younger. So they've really...
I've got some numbers on that if you're interested.
Oh, yeah, 100%. Yeah. Hit me with it.
So I dove deep. Obviously, last year they had a bit of a press conference about this. So there's a few articles written, but... you know, the headline, and this is just from Yahoo, is Aston Martin may have earned as much as 80 million in sales due to their cars just being the safety car in Formula One. Stroll said, there's an expression, I didn't believe it, but we're actually experiencing it. Race on Sunday, sell on Monday. Just the impact of the Aston Martin supplying the Formula One car, the impact of Aston Martin supplying the Formula One car has led to 300 to 400 units of the Vantage F1 edition cars. And the reason that they're Vantage F1 is because there's 8 different types of green that you can get when you buy an Aston Martin. The Formula One green is the one that people purchase en masse. That's the one that they upsell you on. And this is from the New York Times. And this, again, this is from last year, but it's around this time last year, April, May. And I'll read direct. Aston Martin executives point to a January brand health study that showed a whopping 96% of U.S. customers feel the association with Formula One makes them more likely to consider the brand. 98% of Aston Martin owners feel Formula One's halo makes the cars, quote, more exciting to drive and, quote, improves the brand technology credentials. Aston Martin has generated, they said, perhaps 60 million in sales in this particular article. And by the way, those cars, American at the time, cost $178,000. And Stroll said, you know, that and we'll get to the performance of them. He said, he's an avid car collector. He said, I always felt with Aston Martin that the beauty of the brand never matched the performance, meaning that, that they were more beautiful than they were performing. And yeah, I think that they've gone a long way to try to change that. And I'm going to keep going with the stats because I think they're interesting. 24% of new car buyers choosing one of the company's 9 shades of green. So you didn't see a lot of green cars on the road before. You just don't. You'll see a lot of silver, champagne, black, white, just generally. And like, I think brands like Lexus won't sell them to you in any other color. Aston Martin, like I said, has 9 shades of green. I got that wrong. And 24% are choosing that. After the first podium last year, remember where Fernando finished, third, I believe. And then, Lance was 8th. There was a 29% increase in website traffic the next day. 72% of buyers, you know, get the racing inspired Vantage F1 edition model launched in 2021. And market research indicates 88% of luxury cars car buyers are interested in Formula One. So obviously, if you're trying to connect with a high-end audience, like, you know, it's the reason why you see Rolex on there. That's why you see these big brands. There's an enormous brand association. And Tim, I think the other thing that's really interesting is in 2022, Aston Martin issued a statement that said targeting 2030, that would be the end of the line for internal combustion engines. And this is the other big story from the weekend. They are now going to reverse that. Lawrence Stroll said, as long as we're allowed to make ICE cars, internal combustion engine cars, we will make them. I think there will always be a demand, even if it's small. So they're going to make them well into the 2030s. My question to you is, a lot of technology that goes into real cars, like road cars, is developed in Formula One. Hybrid technology was pushed along significantly by Formula One, cars that we see with hybrid engines now. Is it possible, because we know that there is not enough electricity in the world to power the world's cars if everybody went battery tomorrow, is it possible that Formula One, you know, with its net zero commitment, finds new types of fuels that can potentially be, you know, it doesn't mean it's not oil-based. I don't know enough about the science, but is it possible that the internal combustion engine continues with green fuel?
That's the goal, right? Is to run with sustainable fuels in 2026 and beyond in Formula One. And you have a lot of different gas companies, we'll call them, working on that initiative, trying to come up with different forms of, is it a biofuel? I mean, there are other forms that you can derive a bit of, you know, you can turn some of this into liquid and then obviously power your vehicle. There's a company out in Squamish, BC called, Carbon Engineering. And essentially they pull CO2 out of the air and they basically mix all of that with H2O. And essentially, it's a fascinating thing, and I don't want to bore everybody with this, but essentially they're able to pull the CO2 out of the air and turn that into fuel and have it as what it's called, like a drop and go. So you can just pull up to the gas station, your ICE wouldn't need any different modifications to it to run with this.
So you could run a current road car on this fuel.
Yes. Yeah. So there's another, they use it for, I believe it's called capping. And essentially, they're pulling CO2 out and they're capping like oil wells with it. They're turning it into the liquid form and filling, you know, oil holes out of. So where we pull oil from the earth, they're filling that with a lot of this CO2 that we're pulling from the air and putting it down in. I think it's called like requestering. I can't even. I'm going to screw this whole thing up. I'm not a scientist.
That's all right.
But essentially, like it's that's another sort of form of. And I think, you know, that is the goal. Like, that's the goal for F1 is to try and get to that net zero by, you know, 2030. But to make sure that they're running sustainable fuels by 2026. And so, like, I wonder how much, like, if F1 and everyone that they're working with on the project is able to pull it off, like, I'm curious to see how that would change our market.
Yeah.
Like, how is that going to change... like the road cars, like what does that do in terms of like, cause like, you know, government, you know, gets involved at some point with the electric vehicle stuff. And I don't know. It's like you had said, is the infrastructure big enough? You know what
yeah.
I mean?
Yeah. Like, then the
sustain
other thing,
all that?
The other thing is that Stroll and like, when you were talking high end sports cars, I don't think the average driver cares too much about this, but as a race fan, you grew up with grunting, snoring, screaming engines, right?
Yeah,
like
yeah,
you
yeah.
really did. And so when the Aston Martin people did a control test on their potential buyers, all of them said they liked the smells and the sounds of race cars. And so that's why they're part of the reason why they want to continue with it is because if you're buying one, you want to have that experience. And like I've driven a McLaren Artura and they're very cool, right? Because you can switch. They're the EV McLarens. You can switch back and forth between the internal combustion engine and the battery. So when you're in city, you don't need to be screaming around, and it is absolutely silent. You can't hear, or you can hear everything. You can, if you're driving by and there's a people 10 feet away having a conversation on the sidewalk, you'd be able to hear every word, Tim. It's crazy. Yeah. But you get out on the highway, you flip it into gas gear, and it's first off, they're rocket ships, but they sound great still. And I asked the guy who was the rep about it, and I said, so who's your target audience here? And he said, we are looking for younger adults that have come into money or have money, family money, whatever, that are very interested in not just the sounds and the smells, but also in the future. What's the technology of the future? You know, I want to have the leading edge tech in my car. So there may be something that Aston Martin does there. Their next or their first EV was due next year. It's not going to come out until 2027.
I sat down and I want to say it was 2019. I sat down and did a one-on-one interview with Ross Braun about a lot of this. And he had said to me, like, it's difficult to replace every single ICE that's out on the road now. He said that's close to impossible to take, you know, everyone's internal combustion engine car, like, away from them. Trucks, tractors, boats, planes, like, it's, you can't just take all this stuff away. He's like, there has to be another form of energy that can come in and keep these things alive, keep them going, but in a sustainable fashion. And that's when we got talking about sustainable fuels and where is all that going in F1. And he started telling me about, like, well, hey, like, you know, we're working on some of that stuff. And he still sees that, like, the electric vehicle serves a purpose. He thinks that at the time he thought that there would be more than sort of one form that would take us into the future. Like, it could be electric, could be just straight ICE, it can be the plug-in hybrids. I tend to agree with them now. Like, now that I start to see the landscape of things and where we're at just, like, right now, I mean, the hybrids make a ton of sense. Like, they're great. And it's really, the technology itself has come, like, a long way too. Like, it is very smart tech. And then also hydrogen, like, where does that sort of fit in with everything as well? Because now we're starting to get hydrogen involved in motorsports. So, I mean, it's definitely fascinating to see, like, where all that is definitely going. Like, everything needs to serve a purpose, obviously. It was interesting to read those comments in the Sunday Times, like, from that article. And then also, like, he went on, like, Lawrence went on to talk to, like, Road and Track, I think it was. He did an interview there. It's a great article, actually, as well. You should check that out. And I think, you know, a big thing for them is pulling back on the electric vehicle component and going more into that plug-in hybrid sort of direction, where you can still have your performance, but you also have the battery component to it at the same time. It's really fascinating technology. I mean, even back when F1 came in with the hybrid power units and introduced them into Formula One, I mean, the technology that was in those things, Adam, is still to this day, like, we're going back to 2014, still to this day, like, it's absolutely
next level.
Incredible stuff, man. Incredible stuff. Yeah. But, like, just to carry off from that thought and to kind of get back into our Aston Martin conversation and getting back involved with the F1 team, and obviously that being a great thing for them. I think as a car brand itself, we have to understand, like, where Aston Martin, like, used to be. Like, this was a company that was literally struggling to stay alive for not just a few years. Like, we're talking, like, a few decades, right?
Yeah, Aston Martin and losing money were almost ubiquitous.
Man, right? They went hand in hand. Like, and then there were so many different owners of the company over so many, like, Ford at one point owned them.
Yep.
Right?
For, just like they own Jag, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think once they got involved and made the F1 push, like, I think that is what's going to really help this company thrive in the future. And I think for myself, like, not to get selfish about this, but like when I was a kid, Adam, like the DB7. So when the Aston Martin DB7 came out and I saw that car, like in a pamphlet, I was like, that the DB7 to me, and still to this day, and then obviously because I was a kid and I held on to that, my dream car still is. And
really?
So like I fell in love with Aston Martins, and like I always thought, is this company going to survive? Like when I got older and understood like the car market and got involved in it and worked with OEMs and stuff like that,
yeah,
and started to understand the market and being like, oh man, I don't think Aston Martin's ever going to survive, and I don't think I'll ever get to drive one.
I remember the Vantage from the James Bond when Craig took over. That was my, I was like, oh my God, that's the most beautiful car I've ever seen. Now you can get them pretty well priced, actually.
I used to tell my dad, look, yeah, I would put this proposal to him. I'd sit down. I was like, I don't know, whatever, 9 years old, 10 years old. I'd just be like, look, I'm like, you sell the house. We buy a trailer, and we get an Aston Martin DB7, and we just move into that.
How did that how'd that proposal go?
Work out for you? He laughed at me and walked away. So
I'm sure. Well, Tim, listen, we got plenty to cover on Thursday. And, you know, the great thing about the Thursday of a race weekend is we've had media day the day before and watch the drivers take some snipes at each other, get excited for the Chinese Grand Prix. So enjoy. Follow Tim Haraney on Twitter at Tim Haraney or me at Adam Wild. And you can follow at SDPN Sports as well. Tim, thanks so much.
Adam, thanks again, man. Appreciate it.